Greetings, humans. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And we have a very special guest today, the one, the only, the professor, Steve Cannon. I've known Steve for a long time. He played a big part in my being a writer, to whatever extent I am a writer, and the publishing of Sensitive Skin. We were almost partners in a magazine venture at one point. He did Gathering of the Tribes magazine, and we started Sensitive Skin around the same time. So we're always friends, rivals, colleagues. But it was great to talk to him. And again, like I said, I've known him a long time, but I learned stuff about him that I never knew. I didn't realize that he was one of the folks who started the East Village Eye back in the 60s, the first underground newspaper in the U.S. And we talked about how he moved to New York and he knew James Baldwin, Chester Himes, Leroy Jones, folks like that. Then we talked about how he met the great artist and sculptor David Hammons back in the 70s, and how David has helped Steve keep tribes up and working all these years. And then we got onto our great mutual friend, John Farris, how Steve met John back in the 80s at the Neither Nor, which is where I met him too. So I was kind of surprised by that he and I had met John around the same time. He also was instrumental in starting a small press distribution, Poets and Writers, and the readings of St. Mark's Church. I did not know any of this. At any rate, it was great to talk to Steve. And then he gets on my case for not having my shit together and having turned Sensitive Skin into a 501(c) nonprofit organization, which I should have done many years ago. And I made an attempt at it many years ago, and I got off to a false start. And this was, I was confused and broke and didn't know what the fuck I was doing. So never got it off the ground, but maybe I will now. Steve's telling me I got to do it, and I think I just might do it at any rate. And without further ado, here is my conversation with the great Steve Cannon. Let's start talking. I'll just start by asking, what's Tribes up to these days? What are you guys up to?
Nothing. Beyond the Andrew, and take a look at the website. Beyond the Andrew, it publishes other people's books of poetry. I got 4 books of poetry I'm published for this little Jewish woman who used to be part of Living Theater, Jessica Slope. I'm doing her book, I hope, to this month. And this other little chick from Dubai, who I met, Dominique Don, I'm doing her book. Supposed to be out in April too. Then I got to send you my Poonam. I'm doing her book if she ever finishes it. My daughter's book if she ever finishes it. And then Biffin's book if you ever finishes it. I got 5 books supposed to be coming out.
Yeah, that's great.
And beautiful. I'm not doing a damn thing. All I'm doing is helping to promote them. They got their own editors, their own layout design people. They got their own proofreaders, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. Set the thing up, blah, blah, blah. And they set up their own readings and promotion and all that kind of stuff. And I'm doing a little bit helping with promotion.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, you know, you put your stamp of approval on and it means a lot.
And aside from that, I'm working on my memoirs.
Uh-huh. When
now you got the whole picture. Now you got the whole picture.
Right. So, you know what I want to ask you about? I've known you for a long time. When people ask me how long I've known Steve Cannon, I say, I knew Steve before he was blind. That's how long I've known Steve.
Right, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
1,000 years ago, right.
Yeah, but why don't you tell us, so where did you grow up?
In New Orleans.
Uh-huh. And what was that like?
Oh, God, that's a big question, buddy.
Yeah, well, you know, let's start with big questions.
Well, number one, I was born in 1935, before the war. All kinds of crazy shit was happening. And then, of course, during the days of segregation, and, you know, the white folks went to their schools, the black folks went to their school, blah, blah, blah. Ironically, you know, the neighborhood I grew up in. You know, black and white lived right next door to each other, and they were friends and blah, 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 blah. The only thing that made them not friends, which wasn't true, is that the laws didn't allow for them to go to some places, so such as restaurants, bars, schools, churches, etc., blah, blah, blah. But that didn't take away from them being buddies and my friends and all that stuff in the neighborhood. Because they all, you know, share the same neighborhoods. That's all, you know. Mm. But as far as my interests are concerned, growing up in the Yellows, of course, those people down there are crazy about music, 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 music.
Right.
So you learn about music right away. You learn about gambling. They love to love the gambling down there. Everybody gambles in that town. And they love food. So they love three things: music, dance, music, and gambling.
And so, so what got you into literature?
Well, that's the other thing. I was telling someone the other day, you know, since I'm writing my memoirs, my whole family's into reading every damn thing they can get their hands on. And ironically, I was talking about Ishmael yesterday, because he was saying he didn't discover Afro-American writers until he came to New York City.
Huh.
And he learned about everybody as a kid, you know, in school and out of school. I was reading Richard Wright and you know, Paul Ernst Dunbar when I was a little boy, you know, in and out of school at the same time. Mark Twain, Melville, all those people, you know.
When did you start writing?
When I was about 17, 18 years old, when I was blown away by George Bernard Shaw dumping on the English all the time.
Nice.
His preference to his plays. I wasn't sure how ignorant the English were when it came to Irish literature. They didn't know anything. And he would tune him in his essays about who they should be as far as Irish writers are concerned. And I thought that was very interesting that, you know, you got this guy coming from a colonized country being invaded by the British, and he's busy telling the British to go fuck themselves.
Huh.
So I figured that it could approach me Afro-American. Be a good approach for me too. So that was the inspiration.
That's great. I if you gave me like 20 shots to name who your big inspiration was, I wouldn't have guessed Shaw, but he's pretty great.
Yeah, I read all this stuff. You know, especially his preferences. Who else was influenced by him too? I found out years later when I interviewed that guy, it was Ralph Ellison.
Uh-huh.
He talks about being influenced by showing his preferences to his plays.
Yeah.
Because his preferences to his plays, he dumps on the British all the time. You know?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I think that he's somebody who was a huge influence on a lot of people. I mean, he was like, you know, a big, big deal in the, you know, mid-20th century, and he's not talked about so much these days, I think. But, yeah, I think he was a huge influence on a lot of writers.
He's got a big fan club. I keep finding buddy among these young actresses who come in and out of here, call themselves off of me from time to time. This one little chick by the name of Phoebe, she'll probably be out by today because she's staying to see some play next week. She's a big fan of all the shows, but in fact, every time I turn around, she's dragging me to see some play by Shaw. Some of those young actors, they all big-time fans of him. They don't return, they're familiar with Beckett and Ionesco and John Benson Singe and what's the name, Oscar Wilde as well, blah, 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 blah. But Shaw stands out head and shoulders above all those other people.
Yeah, that's interesting that you're naming playwrights. So were you more into reading plays than novels or poetry?
No, all that stuff. All that stuff, all at the same time.
Okay. And when did you, how'd you get to New York City?
Well, that's a long story. Short version of it, I was living in England. And I was thinking I would all these English, all these writers who were wanted to be published, some lucky enough to get published, most of them was unlucky and wanted to be published. So they did jobs and worked for BBC. They used to work for the British BBC radio and television, blah, blah, blah. And that's very interesting, what paid their bills. And I was thinking I went to them. And, you know, we have these long-winded conversations and parties, blah, blah, blah. People in England, they don't go and hang out in bars because the bars close at 10 o'clock. They have parties at the flats. So we were sitting around talking, blah, blah, blah. And they're the ones that got me really serious about writing. So I decided, and that was during the Civil Rights Movement, when it first started kicking off in the South. So I figured if I was serious about wanting to be a writer, the best place to be a writer, to meet other people who are writers, like I had in England, would be in New York City. Because I didn't want to just hang out with Afro-Americans. I wanted to hang out with writers from all over the planet Earth, like I was doing in London. Yeah. So I figured New York would be the place for that, instead of going back down south.
And how'd you end up in England? Were you in the service? Or?
I had been there before, but I was just over there working, as a weather forecaster and all that kind of stuff. You know, the United States government forecasting weather all over the planet Earth and all that kind of stuff. That was back in the days of Sputnik and all that kind of stuff was going on. You know, back in late 50s, early 60s. I came to New York in 1962.
Uh-huh. And who'd you fall in with when you first came to New York?
Baldwin. I knew Baldwin, Miller, that whole crowd, because they was all hanging out over in the West Village. And I was hanging out in the West Village at that time. Mm-hmm. With this guy who father, in fact, I just finished writing about him. His father fired Marilyn Monroe. His name was David Brown. He was a producer for 20th Century Fox. And he fired Marilyn Monroe because she was here up late on the set. In fact, the movie he was working on, if I remember correctly, at that time, was The Misfits. And she was here up late. So David Brown fired him. But anyway, his wife was Helen Gurley Brown, who started Cosmopolitan Magazine.
Uh-huh.
And sons, they were Bruce. He died of AIDS. He was shooting too much dope, and they got dirty needles and ended up dead. But anyway, he was a student at NYU at the time. And his mother, Helen Gurley Brown, she started the editors and started being editor of Cosmopolitan, and she wanted me to write a jazz column for the magazine. But instead of getting me, they got Nat Hentoff to write the column.
Hmm.
So I was thinking about that crowd over in the Village. Then I moved over to this neighborhood because the Rensselaer Chief over here.
Right, right. Where were you hanging out in the West Village? At places like Chumley's or the
the White Horse and Club, mostly Club 55. There's a whole bunch of writers and would-be writers here at Club 55. Chumley's was around, but not as much as Chumley's. And, of course, where the artists were hanging out was over at, I can't remember the name of the bar. It was on University Place.
Yeah. Where all the painters hung out. Shit, I can't remember the name either.
That's where I met Leroy Jones. That's where I met, a whole bunch of writers. And it was mostly writers and painters hung out at that place. De Kooning, piece like that. The other place is Fatback Pussycat. But the Fatback Pussycat, you know, was a coffee shop over on Thompson Street. And so a whole bunch of people used to hang out there, too. Years later, of course, we started hanging out at Max's Kansas City. And, of course, we hung out at Max's Kansas City. It was writers and artists for the most part. But that was years later.
Yeah. And that's around the time you wrote the infamous novel?
Yeah, that's when I was hanging out with Gerodius, because Gerodius came to New York from Paris, and he put the word out that he was in publishing erotic literature by writers here in New York City. I forgot. I think he was a friend with the guy who saw the Evergreen Review. What's his name? Bonnie Rossett.
Yeah.
They knew each other because Rossett had published Suffering from Cancer in this country, and Joey's father, Jack Kahane, had published all the Henry Miller and Chester Himes and some other writers over in Paris. So when he came to town, he put the word out to these interested writers. And this friend of mine from Chicago who was there on St. Bart's Place, a guy named Clarence Mazier. He used to come and bother me all the time and talk to me about writing and this, that, the other, whatever on the scene. And he came in one day all happy and told me he got a contact to write a book with this guy by the name of Gerodius, I call All Night Visitors. And I told Clarence, I said, oh, shit. I said, why don't you talk yours about me? He said, well, I didn't know you were just writing a damn novel. He said, see, it's his number. psychology or this until what I had in mind. So Joseph said, well, here's what you do, Steve. He says, put together a chapter and put together an outline and send it to me, and I'll decide yes or no. So I did what he told me to do. And he said yes, and gave me a check. And I went over to Dear Neville. And that's how that happened. And then I started hanging out with him. And we would go bar hopping from Max's Kansas City, which I crawled over the village over here to the Lower East Side, walk all over the Lower East Side, or walk over the village. And he would spend a lot of time telling me about his days growing up in Paris, his father being a big-time publisher, and what he was doing here, and who he liked, who he didn't like, blah, blah, blah. He and I became big-time buddies over the bar for being my publisher. He's a good guy because he was filled with stories and he loved literature, and he admired writers.
Yeah, I did not know that was Gerodius. What was their, I can't remember. What's the name of their famous Olympia, right? Olympia Press?
Yeah, Olympia Press, right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And his father, I guess it was his father, was the first one who published like James Joyce and, you know, and then he published Burroughs and was the first one to publish all the beats, I guess.
Yeah, he published Chester Himes, he published Henry Miller.
Right,
Ernest Lynn. And Lawrence Durrell, and he published all those people over in Paris.
Right, and opened the doors for a lot of people when he had the big obscenity trial. What was that, like 1960 or something like that? I think it was.
Well, that's a long, different story. Who got in trouble with that? Because I got back to the United States. When I got back to the United States, I remember going to Times Square and going to a bookstore in Times Square. I think it was called Bookmasters at the time. Anyway, and asking the guy who ran the bookstore, did he have a copy of Traffic Cancer? Because Bonnie Ross had just published that book. And the guy looked around and see what, make sure that no one was spying on him and blah, 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 and that I was an undercover cop and all that kind of stuff. He looked on his counter and grabbed a copy of the book and gave it to me. And next thing I know, Bonnie Ross had to go to court to defend that book. And he lost all kinds of goddamn money. Damn, he lost his shirt defending Henry Miller's Traffic of Cancer. But that's a book that put Miller on the map of this country. And then, of course, he all of a sudden, people started recognizing him as a writer all over again, you know. Mm-hmm. Then he came back and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. You know?
But I had read all that Henry Miller stuff when I was living in England because I used to go to Paris all the time and pick up those books, The Traveler's Companion, you know, his father's publishing company. You pick up, you know, the bookstalls on the side of the Seine, and you would pick up all of those books. So I had read all that stuff before I got to this country.
those were great court cases because after they, you know, they said that Tropic of Cancer wasn't obscene, and then there was, I guess, maybe it was a separate one for Naked Lunch. It was like, well, you can write anything now, you know.
Yeah, and Joyce had gotten away with Ulysses years before.
Mm-hmm.
All that shit he had gone on that book. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what were you doing in the '70s? Is that when you were working with Ishmael Reed?
I know what I was doing in '70s. Me and Ishmael. I met Ishmael when we first came to town. Ishmael came to town in 1962. I met him in the spring of 1962, and he was working as an auditor in a hospital at the time. Had been writing up in Buffalo. Had dropped out of college up there, and came to New York. And through a connection of mine with a friend of mine, I got him a job working for some newspaper. Some guy went to Southern newspaper over in New Jersey called The Advance, and he hired Ishmael as the editor of that newspaper. Then he and I got together with a guy named Alan Kaplan, and we started a newspaper down here in Lower East Side called the East Village Yellow, and started publishing a whole bunch of writers. In fact, I saw Ed Sanders yesterday. He was at that thing for Engetty. And we sent Ed Sanders out to cover the Manson trial out in L.A., when Manson killed all those people out there. And Ed Saunders wrote a whole series of articles about that for these village other. He published it in a book called The Family. So we did that. We had the first underground paper in the United States at that time.
Wow, so you were involved in the East Village Other? I didn't know that. That's
we saw it.
Oh, that's awesome. That's
we
amazing.
Saw it. Yeah,
yeah. And the family's Darius James is the one who told me I had to read The Family because we were talking about the Mansons, and my only exposure had been the Bugliosi book, right? Which is, you know, like the cop book version of the story, the total square version of the story.
Yeah, and there was another version too called Helter Skelter. Right. But I can't remember who wrote that.
Yeah, yeah, that was the Bugliosi book, the Helter Skelter.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But that's the one that blamed it all on, like, the Beatles and...
But we knew, it's not as effective, like I said, I just saw Ed yesterday, because he read it to see, you know, for him, yeah, he's talking about the first time he read it. Frilling Getty. Ed Saunders, I was living on 10th Street in Avenue B overlooking Tompkins Square Park. He and Tully Coffinberg was right down the street. They had a publishing company, and not only did they Fuck You magazine, but they also published a book that's called, Peace Bookstore.
Right.
And, then they published those because there's a couple of pacifists, blah, blah, blah. So when that thing happened, we got our money together, East Flagella, and sent Ed out there to cover that trail for us. And published all a series of articles by him, and he later turned into a book, you know. But that's what me and Ishmael was doing. Then Ishmael got published because they were running after writers like they're doing now. Every time you turn around, these publishers get all hopped up and start chasing after writers. And Ken and Laurie started looking for writers and blah, 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 blah. And they published Ishmael Freelance Fallbearers. And from there, you know, the party was on. And then me and Ishmael got together and decided to start our own publishing company. We started a publishing company called Reed, Cameron & Johnson. And we must have published about 20 writers and blah, blah, blah. And then we went our separate ways. Ishmael moved out to California. Well, he was out in California anyway. Me and George Johnson was here in New York. And we published some books that became quite well known and blah, blah, blah. In fact, one of our artists, she's having a show at the Museum of Modern Art this fall, Betty Czar. And the guy we published him by the name of Joel Gunn, we got him to direct a movie that we produced. And his play, Joel Gunn, won all kinds of awards. And her art is going to be displayed from that book we published at the Museum of Modern Art in the fall of this year. So, you know, we sat around. And that's where I got the inspiration of, continuing to publish it way back in those days because we had experience of doing that stuff for over 20 years. And then when we did it, we just got our money together and published what the fuck we wanted to publish. That's all. We didn't have to answer to anybody.
Yeah.
We just did it.
And when did you meet David Hammonds?
When he first started coming down the Lower East Side. David, according to what he told me, he got to New York back in about 75 or 76. He came here on a fellowship to artists in residence to do a show at the City Museum up there in Harlem. He lived up there in Harlem, but was an accident in Harlem, so he would come down the Lower East Side. I met him through John Parrish because David told me he preferred to hang out with writers than hang around with artists because he got tired of them complaining about not being able to have shows here and complaining about this and that and blah, blah, blah. He preferred to be around writers because at least what he told me is that writers would sit down and argue over ideas. So he wants to be around that more than he wants to be around painters. That's why he started hanging out with writers. And John used to write critiques of his work from time to time. And I met him through John, and he and I became friends over a period of time. And I remember when I saw the Tribes, I was sitting in the New York Rican Poets Cafe, and they were going to do all kinds of wonderful things on the magazine and do this and do that. And they were inviting big-time writers or poets to read at their cafe from time to time, but no one was documenting the shit. And they said they were going to send a magazine. That never happened. And I'm sitting in the bar, and Dave was sitting at the other end of the bar. It was a Wednesday near night, and I turned around to tell David, I said, man, these motherfuckers are sitting there talking about they're going to start a magazine, and it never happened. I said, fuck it, I'm going to start a magazine. So David jumped off the off to a bar stool and started dancing. And I say, hey, great, man, great, great. And next thing I know, Bob Holman's wife, Elizabeth Murray, the artist, she came out and gave me the first check to start Sartorius. That's before I even got to 501c3. Then after that, you know, David's been funding this place ever since. In fact, he just sent me a check for $50,000 about a month ago.
We're talking about Tribe. When did Tribe start? I can't remember if the posts on Cibla came out first or if Tribes came out first. We had like...
Well, let me ask you a question. When you guys do your first issue, you remember?
I think it was 91, like fall of 91. And you're in it. It was me, you, Darius, Ferris, Norman, Tom McGlynn, I think, did some art. Yeah, but you were in that very first issue. So they were really right about the same time.
No, we can't wait for you guys.
Okay. All right. All right. I'll give you that.
I'll tell you what happened. I don't know if you remember it or not. When I came with the idea, I approached you and Norman to start the magazine. Mm-hmm. Y'all decided y'all didn't want to do it. The reason y'all decided y'all wanted to do it because you guys were disappeared, getting the fuck out of town. You're going to Spain or France or some goddamn place.
Yeah.
And y'all disappeared and left town. And then what I did, I decided the best way to do was to get somebody young, you guys' age, to start. And I'll work as a consultant since I was old and knew all these old ass writers down here, including Alan, people like that. It'd make a good combination because you guys would know all the young writers and I would know the old people, you know, like Ishmael and Alan, all those bees and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so that didn't pan out. So what happened is that I met this young lady who used to do readings at the New York Post Cafe on Wednesday by the name of Gail Shoker. Mm-hmm. And what I found out about Gail, because this friend of mine was still teaching at the time, regular college, and I was losing my eyesight, this friend of mine, Jose Fuentes, used to come and pick me up at, I was teaching night classes, he would come and pick me up and bring me back to Lower East Side after my classes that day because my eyes were gone. And I can ride in subways because I couldn't see that well. And anyway, one night he picked me up and he took me to what do you call that place? The Knitting Factory, which is still on Houston Street at that time. And Gail was doing readings there on a Wednesday after Wednesday night. And I went there with Jose because he knew the same person. He said, "Man, they got the heady reading from her biography over at." And then, Pat, you want to go? He said, yeah, you can drop by there before I take you back to your house. So we went there, and Gail was the person presenting, hey, reading. So I told her, I said, look, I said, you're just the kind of person I want to meet. She said, why? I said, because you're the first young person I met who admire and show respect for older writers. I said, I'm starting this magazine, and I need someone to work with me who knows the young writers and not the old writers. I think we make a good team. So what we did, we planned the magazine for a whole year. And then we finally brought out the first issue. And who was on the cover of the first issue is David Hammonds. And we sold that piece for $25,000.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we sold that issue for $15,000. Because we interviewed David, put him on the cover, and he gave us a piece. We sold a piece for $25,000. Who collect out in California bought the first issue for $15,000 from us.
Nice. So you always had much better backing than we did. You know what my memory is? And again, believe me, my memory is, I have a weird memory. Sometimes I like remember things photographically. Other times it's just like big blurs, you know? But
right.
my memory was, I remember so... Yeah, you had talked to me and Norman about it. You'd been talking about it right. for a while. Then we pissed off to Paris, and then we came back,
yeah.
and we had done a little thing.
By the time you got back, I had the first issue out.
Okay, my memory is you were about to do it, and then we put out like our little first issue, which is like eight little pages, right? And then that was like, what really got you go, you said, okay, if these guys can do it, that's it. I'm done. I'm getting this thing out now. That's
yeah, but I didn't want to do it. And I think it was a mistake for me to do it.
Really?
Yeah, because me and Israel, we had done all that shit in the '60s. I don't want to repeat those years.
Uh-huh.
We had all kinds of magazines down here in Lower East Side in the '60s.
Right.
All kinds, man. And we did all that shit on the cheap. We started off back in those days. We're the ones who started something called small press distribution those years. We're the ones who started poets and writers those years. All kinds of wonderful things happened in the '60s that didn't happen in you guys' generation.
Yeah, you were part of small press.
We were part of all that shit. Wow. All that shit.
Wow.
All that shit started at the same time. We were all young. We had a lot of energy, and we had our own shit.
Right. Right.
You know, the same thing with underground newspapers. First underground newspapers down here on the Lower East Side. Next thing you know, had underground newspapers all over the goddamn country, based on us and the one down here on the Lower East Side.
Hmm.
And all kinds of other shit happened too. We had poetry reading. We started reading the St. Mark's Poetry Project.
Yeah.
To give you an example of what I'm talking about.
But I mean, I remember when you started Tribes, there was like, and then we did Sensitive Skin. There was nothing going on, right? Which is also.
Well, that's what I mean. That's why I think it was a mistake.
Hmm.
No, the reason I thought it was a mistake, I thought you guys should, it was you guys, sir, and y'all should did that. Not me, because I had my chance back in the 60s. And we had made our statement.
Yeah.
In fact, we had gotten so far, me and Disrolls were publishing books at that time.
Yeah.
But we had published about 20 books by the time I met you guys.
Yeah, but you've done like some great stuff over the last 20 years. You guys have published a ton of books. You got a bunch of print issues out. You started a lot of careers, you know?
No, that's what I'm saying. But I didn't want to do it because I figured we had done all that before.
Yeah. But
I fish roll is coming right now. We'll be sitting on here talking about going down memory lane about, like I'm writing my memoirs right now. We'll be talking about, you know, how we met James Baldwin, how we met Norman Mailer, how we met this one, how we met that one, how we got this one to help out, how we got that one to help out, blah, blah, blah. The same thing happened with David Hammons. When David Hammons came down Lower East Side back in the 70s, he didn't know the artists I knew back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He was just out to New York. You follow? So me and I had met who was kicking ass, Andy Wall, all those people back when he first started his careers and got off the ground. That Max of Kansas City, and that the other bar we talked about over at the university place where all the artists are out. You know, the same thing with the musicians. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
But you guys get to see it was a whole different world, and I thought it'd be more beneficial if you guys took the ball and ran with it, and not me. I was too fucking old.
Yeah, yeah. But you ran with it, though.
Well, I wanted you guys to start the magazine and not me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I want you guys. Every time you had a fight with among each other and get along, I'll pay referee or some bullshit like that. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of silly fights among people back then. And today, too, I think, too.
It didn't pan out that way. That's the only reason I started.
Yeah, yeah. But are you publishing the new Shavisa Woods novel, or is that another imprint?
I got her started, too.
Right.
I met this guy. What's his name? I couldn't have got the guy's name who introduced him to her. I had Amy at the same time. I met Amy over at St. Mark's, over at Eureka Ports Cafe. She came to town, and I got into moving with me and helping them retire. And then she used to say anything. She was on St. Louis, and this guy brought her to New York, and she lived with me, and I published the first book. You know, I'm still in touch with her.
Yeah, yeah.
She's at McDowell now. She's all happy. And I just sent out a mass email for her. But it's a fundraiser note to raise money for her to go on tour. And she just finished writing this book about the Me Too, about her experience with the Me Too, a movement of people who abused her as a young lady. You know? But that was years later. I mean,
yeah.
And so 1997, 1998 or something. I started Tribes back in 1991.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you. I'm also curious about this. I always wondered, how did you meet John Ferris? Because Ferris is the one who introduced me and you back in like 86 or 87 or something like that.
I think I met John down the street from here. You know, at Neither Nor, really.
Oh, that late in the whole thing, in the 80s, huh?
Yeah, because I was busy teaching and shit like that. I wasn't in all the ways at all.
Uh-huh. Huh.
You know, but I would go over to the readings at Neither Nor, and that guy Rick was so he had a scene going over, and John was running the poetry readings on what was it? It was once a week over
Yeah,
there.
yeah. That's where I met. That's where I met. Neither Nor was on 6th Street between C and D. It was Rick Van Valkenburg's place, and it was like a magazine store. He had all the, the.
Right down the street where I'm living now. I'm
Yeah.
living on the 5 East 6th Street
Yeah.
between right down the street from it. It was different. It was Pinero and that guy Eddie. And everyone and all this was shooting dope and getting high all the
Yeah.
time.
That's what I mean. That's what I stumbled into that place like shortly after I moved into the Lower East Side in like 84. And then I saw they had Between C and D magazine. And that's where I met John. That's where I met Darius, Miguel Pinero. And,
Yeah, Pinero was different. I had a book party from Pinero that space.
Yeah.
Him and Miguel Alger, both of them had books published by Arte Publico in Houston. I knew that guy Canella some years ago because Arte Publico, he got, I don't know, about $50,000 from Rockefeller Foundation to start that publishing house in Houston to publish some Chicano writers. But I had met him back in the 60s when all these small presses started at the same time,
Right.
back in the 60s. And he goes back to those days. But that's when I met John. He was doing the research. I didn't know John back in the days of Life Cafe. Norman told me years later, he met John when he was living in the back of the Life Cafe on 10th Street now to read. But I didn't know him back in those years. I didn't read him until, like I said, until even our days.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have thought you would have known him back in the 60s, but I guess he was into different things.
He was on the scene. He was on the downtown scene.
Right.
I told me a story that I did an interview with him for John Reno's newspaper. And John told me he had been the bodyguard for Malcolm X up there in Harlem, and he got out there and blah, blah, blah. And he was a loner. And John didn't really stay hang out with a whole bunch of writers, and black or white. He just hung out by himself. He ended up knowing Roy Barak and those people when they had the Black Arts Movement up there in Harlem. But he wasn't really close to him, according to what he told me. He just knew those guys. But John was never one to join, a group of writers and become a big thing with a whole bunch of writers and shit like that. That was his style. But you know how John was.
Yeah, but he was kind of he was a mentor to, he adopted a bunch of us, like me and Norman and Emily Carter and, a few others, and took us under his wing and kind of showed us around the Lower East Side back in the day.
I agree. I mean, it was a whole different world from the world I knew, blah, blah, blah. And I'm glad that John decided to do that for you guys. Because when I got to New York, people did it for me. It was people like Norman Mailer, people like James Baldwin, people like Chester Hyde, people like Ralph Ellison, people like that. People who have been around the block a few times.
Right.
They came in the Second World War. They had done all this shit during the Second World War. And they became mentors for us when we got down here in the 60s. No, you guys don't do it that way. You do it this way, not that way. You don't do it this way, don't you know that way. You're shortcuts and shit like that. So I'm glad that John was able to pass it on to you guys.
Yeah, yeah. And that was
that's how I did Southern Magazine, because I had done all that shit back in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. And, I remember a funny story. So I was at Neither Nor at, 3 o'clock in the morning one night. And it was kind of a rough neighborhood back then, I guess you could say. And
extremely. All the people had dope guns.
Yeah, dope and guns and people gunfire. You used to have gunfire all the time. And
but it matters worse than that back in the 60s, because you had the riots back in the 60s. We had some serious shit back in the 60s. Yeah. Assassination, all that kind of shit was going on down here.
Yeah.
Motherfuckers back in the days down here.
Yeah, but anyway, there's like these three teenage punks all of a sudden like came up to me and started giving me a hard time, and I was like, uh oh, I'm in trouble. I don't know what's going on. And then John walked up and said, "What do you leave this kid alone? He's a friend of mine." And one of the punks looked at John, it squared off and punched him right in the face, and John didn't flinch. He didn't fucking blink. He just stared at the kid. And then the three of them just like ran out of there.
That's some funny shit.
Oh, that's one of my many great memories of John that I.
No, you and I became big time buddies, you know, once I got to know him. I had to do some Israelites, some David Hinton, I had to do a whole bunch of people, you know, who was on the scene, you know, who didn't know through my contacts and blah, 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 blah. So he got to know this and that one, he yelled, blah, blah, blah. And Israel gave him an award for his novel out there in California because he was in charge of Oakland branch of Penn.
Mm-hmm.
And this friend of mine got me into publishing a book of poetry with John. It wasn't my idea. He told me that I said, well, publish. I wasn't thinking about publishing no damn book. This guy could watch him and say, well, you're going to publish John Ferris. And what do you say that for? Next thing I know, try to start publishing books. Against my better judgment, too. I didn't want to do that. You know.
What was his book? The Ass's Tale? Was that it?
No, well, then the book of poetry was... It's Not About Time.
Right, right, right. But what was his novel called? The Ass's
Tale? Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't publish that.
Oh, you didn't? I thought that was a Tribes book.
None of those people published that. You know, Ron and those people published that.
Oh, it was an Unbearables thing. Okay.
Unbearable. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've just been talking with some people from Bullet Space, Chris and Nico and Andrew Castrucci, they have been going through his papers and his drawings, and they're about to come out with a book of his calling it Last Poems. So,
well, it's beautiful, fantastic.
Yeah.
Any reason why I'm publishing? Good.
Yeah. I'm not sure who's publishing it. I don't know who's publishing it. It might be them publishing it themselves.
I'm glad they didn't bother me about trying to reason why the publisher got anything. Are you going to publish it or what?
I would if, you know, but I think I think they have some, I think they're either doing it themselves or have somebody else in mind.
Why can't they get City Lights to do it?
It's a good question. I don't know.
I know, they can touch me to further get in that crowd out there.
Yeah.
John is qualified. He should be published by a major publishing house in New York. No, but I can't understand why John can't, why can't Judge get published by a New Direction. That's one of your best. Got a publishing house of poetry in this country, and they got offices in New York City. I published a little lesbian girl. We had her through my last issue of Tribes, Elizabeth Watson, and she used to work for New Directions,
mm-hmm.
and they got a good track record.
Well, maybe I'll talk to those guys and tell them. Ask them who they're. I should ask them
who's publishing agent? It. Do they have an agent to represent John's work?
I don't know.
Because if they got an agent that can help, no one can help them find a publisher. Darius.
Maybe so.
Darius is all hooked up.
Yeah, Darius is all the talk of the town these days.
Just came back to town. I went to his reading over at Howell a couple of weeks ago with Sarah Ferguson, and he did that reading in Brooklyn. Who paid for that? It was the New York Review of Books. And so Darius is all hooked up with New York Review of Books now, as you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I got his book 2 days ago. His new publication of New York Poetry. I just bought it 2 days ago.
Uh-huh. I still have my original copies.
Yeah.
On the shelf. But anyway, is there anything else you wanted to say or talk about before we wrap up?
Yeah, that's about it. That's how those things came about. You guys probably came on before I did. But lucky for me, I was there with... David Hammer's always paid the bills because I had to pay people.
Yeah. I mean, you were always much more big time than we ever were. That's for sure.
He kept me alive. And you know, that magazine is all over the world now. It's in every major collection mm-hmm. in this country, as well as in China and Africa and Europe and everything else. And I just did this anthology, which is at the Library of Congress and God knows where else. I put David on the cover. And that thing is all over the world too. But you said you guys are going to do an anthology. How do you finance that? Because the way I finance it, Tribes is two contributions, and we got grants for the 501c3. We got grants for the magazine and for readings we did, and for the books we published from New York State Council of Grants.
Yeah, my problem is that, and when I'm just
y'all ever do that? since the skin, turn into a nonprofit?
No, never did that. It's always just been like something I've been doing in my quote unquote spare time. But, my kids.
So when you're first, you'll never just set up as a nonprofit.
Yeah, no, we never did that. We were too disorganized to do that.
I did that originally.
Yeah.
Because when I came up with the idea, David Hammond sent me a check before I even got a 501c3. Then Elizabeth Murray came up and gave me a check before I got a 501c3.
Yeah.
And they gave me that because they knew I was going to get a 501c3.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll be able to do it now at this point in my life because I'm kind of like at the point in my life where you were when you started doing tribes 25 years ago. I think that's about, where I'm like, I've got like a little bit more time. I mean, I had to have a day job for a long time. What can I tell you? And it was, I did what I could and when I could. So,
no, I'm not knocking it, buddy. I'm just saying because I got that experience from back in the 60s.
Right.
Now, you gotta remember when I got to New York City, there was no such thing as the National Endowment of the Arts. There was no such thing as the National Endowment of Humanities. Who started that was Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
It was his idea. Well, he got the idea from buddy. He got it from the French. Hmm. He figured they were supporting the artists and writers, the musicians, blah, blah, blah. And the government should do the same thing in this country. So he's the one who came up with the idea of a National Endowment of the Arts and a National Endowment of Humanities. But unfortunately, he died before it became a reality.
Mm-hmm.
He got assassinated. So it didn't become a reality in 1964, 1965. But so once it became a reality, we all jumped on the bandwagon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's where all the small presses started, and this and that and this, blah, blah, blah. There's so much fucking money coming down all over the country from the National Endowment of Arts, and every state and city had its own art council. There's all kinds of money for the arts. You don't have to worry about shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You follow?
It ain't like that now.
But I came out of that spirit. You follow?
Yeah. Well, I hope I'd like to think that I got some of it from you, too.
Yeah. So what I'm saying, by the time you guys came around, no, I guess y'all didn't think that way. And I didn't even think about telling you guys that, hey, man, you should become a nonprofit because you're gonna qualify for all this fucking money and blah, 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 blah. But I neglected to tell you guys about that shit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like I said,
I mean, if you can do it now, you're going. It's just filling up some fucking papers. That's all. Would make it possible to get money for all kinds of things. You just write a proposal. Right now, I got this young lady writing a proposal to get $25,000 to $50,000 for the website, just to pay the writers for the website.
Mm-hmm.
And who's going to offer that money? It's the New York State Council of the Arts.
All right, you convinced me. I'm going to do it. I'm going to get my shit together.
All it is. And it's simple as all hell. It's just filling out forms. Most of that stuff is online in the California Council of the Arts. It's online. It's filling it out. The only requirement you need is a minimum of 4 board members.
Hmm.
And your board members don't have to be active. You just have to be names.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But it relieves a lot of pressure. It takes a lot of pressure off of you. And, when you think of a project, you say, okay, I want to do A, I want to do B, I want to do C, I want to do D.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have someone write the proposal, how much does it cost? You say yes until the money comes in, they do it. That's all.
All right.
It's just an idea.
I'm going to do it.
Just an idea, boss. I'm not saying do it. I'm just.
No, I mean, I've been thinking about it for a long time, and for various reasons, I might actually have the bandwidth to be able to do something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, we'll be in touch. I'll let you know
how
that goes.
Hey, man, keep in touch.
Yeah, it's good talking to you, man.
Hey, good talking to you. Good luck. And when that anthology comes, make sure I get a copy of it.
Absolutely.
What kind of date are you looking at and sending from a person?
The fall, this fall.
You got all your writers lined up and shit like that?
Oh, yeah.
You've given them deadlines?
Yeah, no, I got it all together. I just got to get it to the, it's almost ready to get sent to the publisher for galleys.
In front of.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, man.
All right. And thank you.
Keep in touch.
Thank you for everything,
Steve.
Keep in touch. I will.
Keep in touch, man. Okay.
All right.
Good talking to you.
You too. All right. Bye-bye.